Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
And this is Melbourne Community Radio Station 3CR. My name's Jan Bartlett and I'll be here until 6 o'clock this evening with Tuesday Home Time. On the program today, comment on the bombings in Sri Lanka with Dr. Brian Singaratna, veteran peace and human rights activist. Increasing controversy at the cost of the Australian War Memorial Extension. We're speaking with Dr. Sue Wareham, who's the president of the Medical Association for the Prevention of War. A recording of a speech at the Melbourne Unitarian Church recently by Australian missionary nun Sister Patricia Fox, speaking about the dire situation in the Philippines. Professor Emeritus James Petras speaking to me this morning from New York, and his views on why the US has failed to oust President Maduro in Venezuela. And Louise Byrne and Nadine Rutter talk about efforts to have West Papua included in the next decolonisation committee meeting. The issue we're discussing next is support for a resolution prepared by the United Liberation Movement for West Papua to list West Papua with the UN Decolonisation Committee. And I'm speaking with activists for a free West Papua, Louise Byrne and Nadine Rutter. First to you, Louise, what is the status of this committee? It's been there since 1961. How does it operate?
Well, it was set up during the great decolonisation era, which is after World War II. World War II seemed to release all this energy amongst colonies and they rose up against their colonial powers. So the 60s was a great, and the 50s, was a great period where the colonies, who I'm sure had been wanting independence for a long time, actually got the energy and the space to fight the colonising power, whether it be England, France or any of the others. And so there had to be a kind of a mediating committee, because the choice for the colonisers was to say, OK, off you go, which you can't do because it's a whole transitional period. And the decolonisation committee was that, to sort of oversee the transition. It was probably acting in its most recent form out in Kanaki with the referendum. So that's its job, to oversee the transition from colonies to independence. So it's part of the UN process. West Papua is not on the decolonisation list. It should be, because it had a 12-year period as a non-self-governing territory. And the only choice, really, when you become a non-self-governing territory, where your colonial power is operating under Article 73 obligations, which is a reporting mechanism every year to the UN, your choice then is to become independent or stay with your colonial power in some form or another, or end up as in association with another state. So the Decolonisation Committee is part of that transitional period.
What happens if the coloniser doesn't agree? How has it worked out?
To tell you the truth, I'm not 100% sure, but I'm sure that battle is sitting right in front of West Papua at the moment, and we will find out how far it can be pushed, because what's happening with West Papua is unprecedented within the Decolonisation Committee. Just as an example of how nervous that committee is about West Papua, last year the West Papuan Independence Movement took boxes of petitions up to the UN Decolonisation Chair. His name is Rafael Ramirez, a fairly shonky sort of an individual from Venezuela, but he used to be the Minister for Energy down there. There is a photo on the internet of him poring over the list of names, because this is a book of signatures with 1.8 million signatures. The photo is beautiful, but the West Papuans were forced to take it down after he recanted the next day and said, "I never received this." petition, and West Papua is not on the decolonisation list.
Who lent on him?
Oh, well, Indonesia, of course, yeah. But that's why it was so quick and so fast, and he was absolutely adamant the next day. So the West Papuans had to pull down this photo they'd put up, and I've seen one since, and I just forgot to click it. It was very late at night, and I forgot to click it and save it, but I'll find it. Not that it really makes any difference, you know. It's not as though he was receiving it as head of the committee. He somehow just said, OK, come up to the office.
Well, we need to go back to the 60s, don't we, to work out why West Papua wants to be on that committee, wants it to be decided. What was happening in the 1960s in West Papua?
Can I go back to the 40s? Just because that's where the differentiation with Indonesia really came about. Because the Americans bombed the north coast of West Papua very fast, very quickly, very thoroughly in 1944 and quickly shot in Dutch administrators. And the Americans, of course, were all into self-determination, if you remember correctly, in the 1940s, you know. Maybe not physically, but the war people were, like MacArthur. Okay, and he was kind of in charge of things, however much the political people thought they were. He was in charge. And so the Dutch administrators were flown back in, and it just happened that the Dutch administrator, two of the main ones, were the two who'd stayed there in West Papua during the war, refused to surrender to the Japanese, and led commando troops and intelligence troops of Papuans. They weren't like the old Dutch administrators, who were a bit pompous and arrogant and, you know, racist. These were guys who'd lived with the Papuans during the war. And so they very quickly, and they were very intelligent too, they were Indonesian, Javanese, Dutch heritage, so born in Java. And understood self-determination. One had a PhD in literature, the other was well-versed in administration. So they quickly set up institutions gearing towards independence. They knew the Papuans would have to be independent. So, you know, three big schools, an army, a school of public service, other schools were set up in 1944. While Java and Holland, if you must say, was still occupied by the Nazis and by the Japan. So West Papua had a real jump up with very supportive people and all the American infrastructure that was left behind on their self-determination stuff. So then we move into the 50s, bearing in mind that Indonesia became independent in 1949 and the West Papuans were not part of it. They were registered as a non-self-governing territory. So that's another mechanism, UN mechanism, where you've got reporting facilities. You've got a whole lot of things you can call on, the World Health Organization, all this kind of stuff that comes being part of a UN self-governing territory. And so they went through the whole 50s really developing that. It was like West Papua and Indonesia were just totally different countries.
So there was great expectations.
Oh, yes, totally. But by the Dutch and by the Papuans, and by Australians. Australians were very supportive because they didn't want uneven development across that border in the middle of PNG. So the Australians were right behind this as well, signing secret agreements. They were incredibly aware of Indonesia, so their agreements with the Dutch were signed secret. So this went on throughout the 50s to the point where a parliament was set up, launched in 1961, the president of our Senate went, Alistair McMullen or someone, with a big kind of legal week. I mean, it was huge kind of stuff. So that was in April 1961, and that was just the peak body of regional councils all set up with the training of democracy in mind, recalling that Papuans primarily tribal. So that was 61. And then that council, which even had a woman, had a woman councillor in 1961, went on in the same path, and 6 months later, the attributes of state were announced and done, like, you know, flags and oaths and whatever else. There was a whole lot of stuff. And that was what Indonesia by then had woken up, and they declared war on the Dutch puppet state in December 61. Yeah.
And then?
They declared war, Sukarno declared war, and backed it up. In 1961, Indonesia was the most powerful military force outside China in Southeast Asia. Massive Russian stuff. Even 300 Russian intelligence agents in Jakarta 1961. But also America was supporting as well, militarily, plus diplomatically. So they were playing their usual double game. The Russians were a bit more frank and just said, you know, you can have whatever you want, basically.
Well, they had their eye on the resources, didn't they, the Americans?
That's a hard one to call in 1961.
I thought
there are people who say yes. Obviously, Freeport was found in 1936. The guy who found it lives in Melbourne, up in the hills, and will never talk. But he kind of hid all his information under a rock, and so there were people going in and out looking for this rock.
But didn't the Rockefellers know what was going on? They wanted that resource. Isn't that the story?
I'm not arguing the story. I'm just arguing the time. I'm not quite sure in 1961 whether the bogey was communism or the pull factor was gold. 61 is kind of a hard one to call on that one.
Do we go straight to 1969 or was there something else happening in that period?
1969 is the referendum, which is the final step in the agreement signed in 1962. It's called the New York Agreement. So 69, in a way, is not irrelevant, but everyone jumps on that because it's a referendum and they go, yes, I can deal with this. Whereas if you go back to the New York Agreement, which generated that, that's the devil's document, that one. It's very complex because it looks good, mentions self-determination 17 times. But if you go into the details of it, you can, with a lawyer's eye, you see how slippery it is. And then, in the hands of Indonesia, because the New York Agreement took West Papua for 6 months as a UN trust and then passed the administration to Indonesia in 1963. And so that same document in the hands of Indonesia got slipperier and slipperier until you get to 1969. Yeah. But don't forget, in the middle of that period, you've got the big massacre in Indonesia of, well, the guy who managed it for Suharto, his name is Salo Eddy, who's the father-in-law of SPY. SBY's father-in-law, Salo Eddy, he orchestrated that. And according to him, 3 million were killed, mostly face-to-face killings. So that happens like 2 years before this act of free choice. Now, although this massacre was kind of kept quiet, it was reported, you know, in little columns in the New York Times. It was nothing like what it should have been. It was deliberately kept quiet because of America's involvement in it. On the ground, you know, with all those churches running around back and forth between Indonesia and West Papua and all that sort of stuff, it was well known. So that only added to the tension of the Act of Free Choice in 68-69. So unless you get the two countries' histories kind of working side by side, you can miss the tremendous pressure beyond what was Salo Eddy was actually putting on West Papuans, because they chose 1,000 and secluded them for 6 weeks, re-education, all that sort of stuff. So that's pressure enough. But to know that, okay, this guy isn't just saying things. When he says, I'll cut your tongues out, he was the guy who did it 2 years ago in Java and Sumatra and Bali with his own people.
Before we actually go on to the motion for the going before the committee, what is that intervening period meant for the people of West Papua from 1969 to 2019? What has life been for the people of West Papua?
Just doing the broad sweep, I suppose anything under a racist oppressor is pretty tough. On top of that, there are genocide reports. Now, it's very hard to reach the bar writing a genocide report, but the one that has is the Asia Centre for Human Rights. And they're based in Hong Kong. And they actually sent people to the highlands for 3 years collecting information. And that is an incredible, like, all the highland villages, all the names of people killed, the time, the perpetrator and all that sort of stuff. So that's a very solid, and that happened in 77, 78. And there's a great story associated with that, because in the meantime, a Papuan had gone through the Air Force and got up to the level of flying F-111s. And his first job after graduating was to drop a bomb on Wamana during this 77-78 period. And what do you do as a young graduate? Imagine, you're from this forgotten little part of the empire, You're black. You've got past this kind of incredible barriers to get these wings, and then you're told to drop it on Wamana. So what he did, he flipped it right, flipped his plane right at the last minute, and dropped it in the Arafura Sea, and was immediately stripped, but got his desk job back when Jacob was a student, because Jacob went to the trial. Got a desk job back, but he lost that thing. Yeah. So that's a kind of a small story, perhaps, in the bigger story of genocide. Indonesia always tries to... Let's concentrate on the last 15 years, because there's plenty known about Suharto. I mean, he was an oppressor all over the place. Although, I will say one good thing about Suharto, if you don't mind. He kept away. There was no development. It was fantastic in the light of what's happened since, which is massive development, you know. If you get a chance with Google, is it Google where you can fly over things now? Mm. Oh, look at the governor's palace in Manokwari. It's like something out of China. It's huge. It's huge. And the Islamic temples, they're not just little ones, you know, when people are out evangelizing and that sort of stuff, a little bit humble. These are massive gold tombs, look, something straight out of Saudi Arabia. Magnificent edifices, you know. Great Muslim supermarkets everywhere.
And that brings in the issue of transmigration.
Yes, totally. There are many more non-Papuans than Papuans now in Papua, yeah. And who knows what the breakup will be, like how many will leave. In the past, whenever there's been a bit of an upset, a little riot or a little shooting here or there, the first thing you see are the white trucks lined up on the boats to leave, and they're all the transmigrazis. But transmigrazis are not an homogenous group. You have got free settlers. They're the boogies, which go everywhere and just kind of take over the markets. They're really fast, you know, little profiteer people. They will leave, no doubt. The transmigrazis that came in the organised government things will probably stay, and they are very supportive of West Papua because they've got nowhere else to go. You know, they were given these plots of land. The Papuans evicted, they were given a little plot of land, and the land in West Papua is very infertile. Not infertile, low fertility, you know, because it's tropical. So they will stay, and they are very strong supporters of the independence movement. And then there's another lot. Well, all the military will leave, and all the hard part for the Papuans, I think, are the Papuan teachers and Papuan nurses, because they're working for the state at the moment, you know. So that's the difficulty there.
You are listening to Tuesday Home Time on Melbourne Community Radio Station 3CR. My name is Jan Bartlett, and I'm speaking with activists for a free West Papua, Louise Byrne and Nadine Rutter, and the issue is a resolution prepared by the United Liberation Movement for West Papua to list West Papua with the UN Decolonisation Committee. Nadine, can I bring you into this? How did you get involved?
Well, I was living in Vanuatu last year, and I was working with youth over there, and I saw how much they all knew about what was going on in West Papua. Obviously, Vanuatu has been huge in supporting West Papua over the recent years. And I kind of thought, wow, you know, it's amazing all of these kids are so radical in their support, and you know, there's Free West Papua sort of signs and tagging and stuff all over the student areas in Port Vila. And I was like, I don't know many other young people back in New Zealand where I'm from that know much about this issue. So I thought, right, when I get back, I'm going to find a way to be more involved. And instead of moving back to New Zealand, I ended up moving to Melbourne. Went to the protest outside the Indonesian consulate, and I guess kind of got sucked in from there.
But can you explain a little bit more the connections between Vanuatu and West Papua at the government level as well?
Yeah, so Vanuatu is, they're actually the nation that are bringing the motion to put West Papua on the decolonisation list to the United Nations. So they've been pretty fundamental in building support through the rest of the Pacific as well.
And there's also that motto by Father Leni.
Yeah.
1985 when they became independent. Mm-hmm. Vanuatu will never be free until the rest of Melanesia is free. That was a direct reference to West Papua and Kanaki,
And that brings in that issue of Melanesia, doesn't it? They're not Indonesians, they are Melanesian.
Absolutely. Yeah, they are. And I don't think Australians are sort of quite across the importance of, say, the Melanesian spearhead group. It's well, certainly the politicians aren't and the bureaucrats. But it was, despite the fighting and how long it took and lack of voting and all this sort of stuff, it was the Melanesian spearhead group which was the first to recognise the West Papuan independence movement. So the Papuans say that when they were recognised by the MSG leaders, we moved out of the darkness into the light. So it really took that little group, you know, probably the smallest intergovernmental group in the world. It split the group, and it's been splitting it ever since. Indonesian money has been massive, but they did it. And it's having sort of ramifications. The old independence movement, if I can just go back, so that's the OPM and all that went around the OPM, they used to sort of think Holland and New York, right? And it was when they OPM split in the 70s, some fight between leaders, there was a little bit of a vacuum and no one knew what to do. And it was when this guy, you know, these people, one in one, you know, they just emerge when you need them, the leaders, the right types. So his name was Thomas Wangai, and he said, okay, the big part that's missing in our independence movement is culture. We've just sort of done the top layer, looking to Holland and looking to New York. Why aren't we bringing in our culture? So that was a very difficult process for the Papuans, because in the meantime, they'd all been taught to hate their culture through the racism. So that was actually a very difficult period, but it's been overcome now. It was the Melanesian kin that brought them out of the darkness into the light.
And the people that have been forced out of the country and are living in Australia, living in New Zealand, I suppose, living in America and Holland, how important are they for the struggle?
Crucial. But can I say, unless the relationship is kind of tight with the homeland independence people, I mean, it can get a bit distorted. Like sometimes in Holland, they get a bit confused. And that's under the pressure, I guess, from the Dutch, but also that whole life in the diaspora, where you're just over swamped with kind of multiculturalism and you're just one little kind of nothing really in a sea of cultures. And so you can easily get your messages a bit mixed up, and sometimes they do that far away. Even here, you can get your messages mixed up. But we are a bit lucky in that we've got the only Federal Republic of West Papua office in the world in Melbourne. So we can sort of stay on track, you know, despite all the little things that can go wrong in a struggle, we can manage to stay on track because of that office and Jacob Wumbiak's role in it, you know. So we're lucky. New Zealand's not so lucky, but they haven't got many people either. There's maybe students go down there, you know, they're not kind of well-versed and they certainly haven't got a fertile garden to blossom in down there, yeah.
And what's the essence of the struggle in West Papua at the moment, and how much information can you get out of there about really the situation there for the people?
It's not hard to get information now. Everyone's got mobile phones. So we get pictures and we get lots of data. This, for instance, the most recent data was after the Indonesian Parliament declared war on West Papua in December 18. So then the Indonesian Air Force dropped bombs of white phosphorus on villages. So we even got pictures of a man burn, and it was the Australian military that identified from the burns in the photo off the telephone what it was.
And that's what phosphorus does to you, isn't it? It eats through your body.
Burns. Mm. It doesn't seem, well, according to him, it doesn't stop burning.
No, it just
keeps burning.
Yeah.
And that guy with the big gash in his leg, that photo, the Indonesian Air Force refused to pick him up in a helicopter and take him to hospital. So he just died, like, in agony. I don't know what sort of agony, unbearable. So it's not difficult. There's two kind of things, you know. The intelligence and the army are still, as you would see with the Indonesian elections, you know, they're kind of stuck in their old guardian of the nation, so territorial integrity and all that sort of stuff. So West Papua can never leave. The top intelligence people know that West Papua has to leave, will leave. And in fact, there was arguments even amongst the political class when Indonesia, during the debate about whether they would declare war on the West Papuans in December, there were a couple of generals in the intelligence section who said, don't do this. Those bastards are sitting down there waiting with their fucking phones. We'll end up in the criminal court and all our dirty linen will be aired. It was on TV, you know. Jacob watches it till 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. That's what they said, you know. So there's a something coming through at the top level. So then it's got to get dripped down into the political class, the reactionary class, and then the people, you know.
What can you tell us about this push to get onto the register for decolonisation? How does it work?
In order for the motion to be passed, the motion needs the support of over half of the member states in the United Nations. So, yeah, I guess there's support coming through, obviously, from a lot of the other Pacific Island nations. There's support coming from the APEC group. And I guess what we're trying to do at the moment is get some word from Australia that when the time comes, when that motion gets raised at the General Assembly, for them to support.
And when is that?
That's September this year, September, yeah, 2019.
Have you had any correspondence with them so far to gauge what they're likely to do?
We haven't reached out a heap as part of the campaign as of yet. What we're trying to do at the moment is get the word out that this is happening to the Australian public. I don't think it's an issue that gets talked about enough, you know, given Australia's proximity to West Papua. And, yeah, let everyone know, I guess, that this is a huge opportunity for Australia to, you know, not continue being complacent in what's been going on over there. So, yeah, we're trying to build some support to take to the government to say, look, your population wants you to support West Papua, our closest neighbours, when this motion gets raised at the General Assembly.
And is that happening in New Zealand as well?
I'm not entirely sure what's happening over in New Zealand. I think there's a bit of buzz. I don't know that there's a campaign exactly like what we're doing in terms of lobbying this particular motion. Not that I've heard about. I have been trying to put some feelers out there, so if anyone knows, feel free to get in touch, because I'd love to connect with whoever's working on that over in New Zealand.
We're just sort of doing this tiny little part of, it's just Australia. And you could probably, if there wasn't for the grassroots component, you probably wouldn't bother at all wasting your energy. You know Australia's going to say no. But because of the grassroots component of the campaign, it's worth it. But it's the Papuan leadership, independence leadership, ULMWP. They've been working on this for 3 or 4 years right around the world. And a great example of how effective they've become is that we've been working in Uganda, of all places. And that's sort of central, one of 5 or 6 states around Lake Victoria. And I think for most of us, Uganda, you know, you sort of think, oh, God, Uganda, why would you go there, sort of thing, except they're on the front line of the fight with Muslim terrorism, and they've had their own terrible history as an independence nation, and somehow they've survived and are vibrant. So we've had Jacob Rumbiak and others have been talking there a lot. There's legislation passed in the parliament. And the other day, in the African Caribbean Pacific meeting in, it wasn't Brussels, but one of those countries, when they were debating the draft, whether they would support this motion and the draft that would do it. So that's 79 member states. PNG, in all its glory, followed by East Timor, cloaking itself in more glory, said they were going to vote against it. And who got up and tore strips off them? The Foreign Affairs Minister of Uganda, saying, you're just a failed state, you know, what right have you got to da-da-da-lum, da-da-da-lum, and you're just over the border, you're an idiot, da-da-da-lum. And look, there was this horrible, horrible fight in the middle of the ACP meeting, with Uganda tearing strips off PNG and stupid East Timor. So
I suppose you can understand why PNG have that stand, because they've been threatened by Indonesia forever, I'd understand. But why East Timor?
Oh, God knows. I actually don't understand PNG either. Well, at the deep level I can understand. But They're the ones that can talk. They're like us. So they're just the same as us. Yeah, so they're kind of the least interesting nations to run a campaign in. But we're having fun with the grassroots anyway.
If it doesn't go to the meeting in September, when's the next one?
No, we'll go next year.
So it's every year?
We don't think about failing.
How are you going about your campaign with your grassroots campaign? What are you doing?
So at this point, we are trying to collect signatures for a petition that we are hoping to have delivered to the Senate in August. Have a petition online, so if anyone out there is listening wants to go and sign it, you can just go to www.decolonisewestpapua.com. That will link you through to a change.org petition. You can spell decolonise with a Z or an S. It will get you there either way. Yeah, so that's what we're doing at the moment, collecting those signatures. We also have a physical petition. So again, if anyone wants to run around with a physical petition, you can send me an email at frwpwomensoffice@gmail.com. We can send one of those out to you. More than happy to do that. Yeah, so I guess that's been the first step. It's a bit tricky with the election happening right now. We also have a letter that we're asking people to send out to their local MPs. More than welcome to do that before and after the election, just to see what they can do in order to push this issue through, I guess, to get the conversation happening that people in their electorate do really care about this decision that's going to be made in September. Those are the things that, yeah, we're doing as a starting point.
Are there friends of West Papua in the Parliament?
Yep.
Many?
Not enough, but probably 10. And some of the names might surprise you. And now you're going to ask me who they are. The one that really surprised me is from Cairns. I mean, he came out to the Freedom Flotilla when it went to Cairns, the one going to West Papua, and stood beside Jacob and gave this magnificent interview to SBS and said, one day we will get some common sense and Melanesians will have the identity that they want, Melanesians in West Papua. This guy's been in Parliament for years, years and years, and was surprisingly good on the gay business as well. A lot of those bush people and isolated people are good on these hard issues. He actually started the rights for gays or...
The vote, yes.
The vote. It wasn't the marriage business, it was before that, you know. Mm. He was one that pushed it right from the beginning. Yes, there. I mean, obviously the Greens have got policy, but even amongst Liberals there's people who can remember war, remember fuzzy-wuzzy stuff. They get muddled up a bit about between the two sides of the island. Not enough to get a majority yet, but once Nadine starts cracking the whip and sharpening her knives, that will be totally different.
And we also have to acknowledge the number of West Papuans who now live in Australia, particularly here in Melbourne, and who have a program here on 3CR. And a number of those are refugees who came over, what year was it?
On a boat in 2006.
Yeah. They were lucky, weren't they, to get over that time?
Yes. Oh. In retrospect, yes. Yes, but it was always a bit preordained, that thing, you know. I don't know whether you'll appreciate this, but... soon after, well, a great story about the landing, which we've probably done before, but Amanda Vanstone was the Minister for Immigration, and she told a mole, we've got a few moles around the place that work both for the Indonesians and the, you know, the old sort of intelligence mole. She told a mole, a Papuan mole, that she would look after those people. She didn't know she was a mole. And so it got to us. And so she actually implemented the Palmer Report reforms on that group, based on the fact that there was a kind of a good supporting group in Melbourne, so, and we were working with the Foundation for Survivors of Torture and da da da. So they were very lucky in retrospect. We had no idea of all that at the time, but in retrospect. And Amanda Vanstone lost her job on that issue, yeah. But as she said, I don't mind going to Tuscany anyway.
Can I ask you, Nadine, to just give us some more of those web pages or information for people to do something about this?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, the petition is at www.decolonisewestpapua.com. If you need to get in touch with me, if you'd like a physical petition, if you'd like to help out with the campaign, because we desperately need some more hands on deck around the country, you can reach me at FRWP, so that stands for Federal Republic of West Papua, FRWP Women's Office @gmail.com.
And one of the best things about getting involved is we are copying the Papuans. That's why we've got 1.8, the number of 1.8 million. They are a bit chuffed. That's, you know, down in big sort of Australia, we are copying them because they got 1.8 million. And so what we are doing is now that they are chuffed, we're going to go and exploit it. So we're putting them into boxes like they did from Melbourne up to Canberra on the train, getting special little trolleys designed, okay, to pull the boxes, like the Beatles crossing Abbey Road. The best what? Campaigners?
Yep.
10 of the best are being chosen for that job. They will go down in history, right, mm-hmm. with that one photo.
And that's Louise Byrne, and just talking there with Nadine Rutter about the plan to take it to the decolonisation committee meeting in September. Also, there's another appeal for West Papua.
On March 16, the Sentani region of Jayapura in West Papua was hit by massive flooding and landslides, killing at least 89 people, with more than 6,000 people evacuated from their home. 74 people are missing and 159 have been injured. This disaster is the result of torrential rain coupled with deforestation of the mountains, also poor waste management, polluting and clogging waterways, leading to flash flooding and mudslides. At this time, West Papuan people need your help more than ever. Help us. Reach our goal to raise $10,000 to provide emergency supplies, food, first aid, nappies, baby food and milk formula. All money raised will go directly to Yayasan Abdi Budaya Nusantara, a foundation facilitating the evacuation camp in Sentani, West Papua. Donate online at https://chaf.org/project/flood-relief-for-west-papua. West Papuan people need you. It's time to help, and don't make them feel alone.
And that's about it for me for today. I'll say goodbye, and I'll be back next Tuesday at 4. Bye for now.